Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 299 of the podcast. It is the 10th of December, 2016, as I record this, and very exciting because next week we're at episode 300, and I have a mega show that I've recorded with Mark Lefebvre, and we'll be looking back at my mistakes and lessons learned and what's changed since episode 200 in November 2014. So time really does fly. I think at episode 200, I was considering dropping the show. And now I'm really doubling down on it, as you will hear. So today I have an interview with Melissa Addy, and we're talking about merchandise for authors, which I think is one of the growth areas for indies and something that a lot, you know, some of the romance authors have sorted, but many of the rest of us haven't. And I am not talking about bookmarks here, people. I think bookmarks are the most useless form of merchandise. But with the rise of 3D printing for stuff, and also print on demand for different products like t-shirts, fabrics, all kinds of really interesting things you can do with various print on demand sites now with merchandise. So it doesn't have to cost, you know, stacks of money. So I have personally, I've been teeing up some phone calls and making some inquiries to start working on the idea of a premium journal, which I'll talk about in the interview, sort of a hardback ideal journal, because I write in a lot of journals. I use Moleskine and Leuchtturm, which I've mentioned before, but I'll probably like have some quotes in it and some hand letterpress art and other things like that. So I'm really excited about doing that. I think that will be my first merchandise adventure. So in publishing news, not too much exciting things. I mean, we're in the run-up to Christmas, so literally everything is focused on selling you things. but I did see one thing. It was in an article about publishing conferences, which is not particularly interesting itself, but the line caught my eye, and it's from publishing industry veteran Mike Shatskin, who says, quote, "Publishers can literally reach most of the customers in the world through two intermediaries, Amazon and Ingram. A publisher with no more organization than relationships with Amazon, Ingram, and a talented digital marketing team can publish successfully in today's world." End quote. And there was a dot, dot, dot in the middle there. There were parts of a paragraph. But I thought this was really interesting because Mike Shatskin's an older guy, and his father was also in publishing. And he's a real, he actually has some real forward thinking stuff for someone who you'd think would be very traditional. But he recognizes some of the changes. So basically, in the last week, as I've been saying before, I'm working on this kind of small press. I've been this week loading books up to Ingram. And I'm going to be starting to work with them for some distribution. So it's very interesting that basically if you have Amazon, Ingram, and also a talented digital marketing team, which let's face it, is us. I think anyone who's actually given online marketing a go, you know, it's a great thing to be doing yourself, because most of these publishing houses don't have people who know any better than us. So some of them do. One of the UK publishing houses, Bookature, has done amazingly well, mainly because they've gone ebook only with Facebook advertising and have done incredibly well. Came out the gate, you know, got all their authors up to the top of Amazon. And so I think this is fascinating. So I just wanted to mention that as a kind of, it felt like the playing field for ebooks was level a number of years ago, but it's beginning to feel like the print on demand publishing model might also become more level. So I'm interested in that anyway. And I'll of course be reporting back on my small press experiments. I also wanted to, there was one thing this week, Amazon Go, if you haven't seen it, just Google Amazon Go. In terms of futurist stuff, you kind of, it's a sort of grocery concept. You walk in, you know, like you're out for lunch, you want to grab something to take back to your desk, and you walk into the cafeteria and you grab something and you walk out and you don't have to check out or anything. And I was reading about it, and it's based on sensors. So this is the Internet of Things. Now, the Internet of Things, again, it's another kind of area like 3D printing, like VR, like human longevity. These are the things that technology is looking at, but sensors in lots and lots of stuff is coming as well. So I think that's very interesting. I'm not sure that it would, you know, necessarily work everywhere, but then I'm saying that now as, you know, well, no, let's just say it will work everywhere at some point, because this is technology. And if you think that at the moment people have to go around sticking barcodes on stuff, why can't they stick sensors on stuff? So really interesting on that, I think. I also want to start thinking about your future, because we're coming to the end of the year. And this week I read Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss. That's a big book. But I actually, because I was sick last Sunday, I spent the whole day on my bed, coughing and spluttering and reading Tim Ferriss with a notebook next to me. And I made about 20 pages of notes in my journal from the book, which is excellent. Now, it's distilled from his podcast. And I think there's two reasons to read the book. One, it's a really good book full of interesting tips around healthy, wealthy, and wise. So your health, your money, and, you know, your brain, learning stuff, and very inspirational and useful too. It's not just inspirational, it's very practical tips too. But also for those people who do have a podcast like me, or if you have a lot of nonfiction books, for example, the way that Tim's done it is a very good way of using content to create something new. So he has curated all of the episodes of his podcast and organized them into a very readable self-help book. So I'm not saying I'm going to take that on, because it's a hell of a job, but I found it fascinating how he managed to do such a good book out of his podcast. Because let's face it, there is, you know, with human conversation, there's often a little waffling. But if you get one or two things out of each show, then that's good enough for me. There was one quote that particularly stood out for me. "You are the gatekeeper of your own work," by Mike Birbiglia. And so I'll say that again. You are the gatekeeper of your own work. And I think this is really important going forwards into 2017, because I don't know about you, but I have so many ideas that I want to work on, like so many, and I have to decide which ones to work on. Also, you know, I had Chris Fox on the show, and I'd still get emails from people saying, "Oh, hate the idea of writing to market." And it's like, well, nobody says you have to. you are the gatekeeper of your own work. We are indies. You make the choice yourself. Or if you're a public, you know, if you want to get a publisher, great, but you're still the gatekeeper to what you actually write. So you get to decide how you spend 2017. It's only a year. This time next year, what do you want to say you have created? And it better be something. I would definitely hold you to that. It has to be something. But yeah, you're the gatekeeper. You decide what that will be. So you start thinking about that. And also combine that with the interview with Derek Sivers, which I always think is amazing. It's got to be a hell yeah or a no. And really curating your life in 2017. So either it's hell yeah, I want to do this, this is brilliant, or no, that doesn't fit into my plan. That should help you decide what to create in 2017. Oh, and one more future thing. We have a Echo Dot. My husband bought it. When he bought it, you know, the Alexa thing that goes in the corner, Amazon's AI thing. I don't even know what to call it, but it's an Echo Dot. You say, "Alexa, turn the lights on," and "Alexa, play music." And it's been really interesting. And
because when he first put it out, I was really resistant and I told him to pack it all up because I didn't want something listening in my house. And it was so funny because, you know, I think I'm such a futurist, and yet I was like, no, it's listening to me all the time. And yes, it probably is. But I've actually now become really happy with it. And I'm not someone who listens to music very much. I have silence or the sound of rain and thunderstorms when I write, or I listen to podcasts and audiobooks and things. But I've actually started listening to music again, which is awesome. You can get these playlists. And anyway, it's just a very friendly AI. And I wanted to mention it because, well, one, they're really cheap this Christmas. So if you want to start getting an AI in your house, and they have all these skills, they're called skills, where Alexa can do various things. It's also Easter eggs. So my husband's always like asking her things like, Alexa, are you Skynet? And she has all these things that she can say, or what's the meaning of life? And it's very fun. And I was thinking futurist, what is this for? I think this is just the beginning. And I think about my mum, who is obviously older and alone. And I really like the idea of having something that she can talk to and it will do things. So obviously it can't make you breakfast or a cup of tea or anything. But I would love, you know, if she was in bed and things are difficult, that she could say, Alexa, call Joanna, or something like that. And so I'm really thinking that these types of devices will become ubiquitous. I actually think this type of device will be more adopted before VR. So yeah, AI plus skills. fun. Okay. So my personal update this week, I mentioned the small press already, but this week I've spent a bit of time starting to build the website and looking at publishers' websites and sort of figuring out what I need. And it's really interesting to change my mindset from author to publisher, because as authors, our websites are aimed at readers, and publishers' websites are often aimed at book buyers. So, you know, rights buyers, that type of thing. So I'm really fascinated by how this is making me appreciate some of the processes that traditional publishing use. I'm also understanding how everything takes more time as I work with Ingram. So what I'm likely to do is actually do a press release in January and sort of, you know, come out with a bang and not reveal that website before January, because it's quite a big deal. You know, a lot of people have emailed me and said, oh, hey, you know, I set up a small press when I started self-publishing. And I'm like, actually, just because you have an imprint name on your ebook, you know, or your print on demand book, is not quite the same as setting up a small press and doing all the things that publishers do. So I'm working on a big, and it's like turning out to be a mega blog post, from indie author to small press, because a lot of you have asked for that. And as ever, I like to chronicle the journey and lessons learned. So that will be coming in January. This week, I've also posted a blog post about Enid Blyton's, but the famous five parody books currently out in the UK for Christmas. And they are, they have Enid Blyton on the front. They look like famous five. And they are, I was fascinated by this because thinking about intellectual property rights, this is obviously not written by Enid Blyton. It's things like five go gluten-free, five go to Brexit Island, this type of thing. And it turns out that Enid Blyton's signature, as well as Enid Blyton and Famous Five, are trademarks owned by the publisher. So even though the author is different, they can use these trademarks on the front. And there's a very tiny trademark symbol near Enid Blyton's signature that is disguised as a speck of dirt. And I put this on the blog this week, and I'll put a link in the show notes, or just Google the creative pen Enid Blyton and you'll find that post. But I wrote about what we can learn from this, you know, like, for example, should we, because her signature is what's recognizable, should we use a signature on the front of our books and make that a trademark? I think that's a really interesting idea. At the moment, we all use standard fonts. None of our, you know, the trend now is not to use signatures, but it's something I'm certainly thinking about, and a couple of other ideas around products and intellectual property rights. So fascinating. I am still working on end of days edits and putting together my plan for 2017 for JF Pen, the creative pen, and the small press, which are all kind of different things now. So busy times. I have a book bub this weekend on Sunday, 11th of December. Now you'll be listening the day after, but if you go and check out the London Crime Thriller box set, if you would like a darker holiday season, then you can get that three full-length crime thrillers for 99 cents or 99p if you're in the UK, on all ebook stores. So if you fancy a darker read this Christmas and you want to look inside my brain, then check out those books, the London Crime Thriller series by J.F. Penn. Those are my London Psychic books, slightly rebranded. and I booked the BookBub because I want to see the impact on the audiobook box set, which is a new kind of concept. Not many people are doing it at the moment. So it will be very interesting to see whether that impacts the sales, because it seems that many audiobook listeners look for ebook deals and then buy audiobooks off the back of that. I'll also be in the studio this week. I didn't do last week because I had that cough, but this week I will be in the studio recording How to Make a Living and Successful Author Mindset. And I will do non-exclusive with ACX on that. And if you missed that interview with Dan Sawyer on audiobook rights, that's also on the blog this week. And of course, I've been selling the Successful Author Mindset on my website, but a number of people have said, look, I just want to get it on the Audible app. It's much easier than trying to download it to my phone. So as long as you go non-exclusive, you can sell your stuff wherever you like. So that's the plan. Also, just a reminder that I have a new free webinar series. The first one was last night, as you listen, or my tomorrow as I record. And we did How to Write a Novel. And this coming weekend is How to Make Money with Books on the 18th of December. And then Planning for 2017 on the 29th of December. And if you register, you'll get the replay. So check out thecreativepen.com/learn. I've also had a request to do a webinar on how to write nonfiction. So that will be coming probably in January, and I'll be doing more of these because there's just topics I'd like to cover in a longer way. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets. Here's just a little selection. Natasha says, listening to your podcast while I walk the dogs. We would miss your podcast, which is helpful. I've changed my life. And I also finally bought my first book by you on Business for Authors. I wouldn't have done so without knowing you through the podcast. My evil plan has worked. 300 episodes and I've made you buy a book. Oh no, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Natasha. That is great. Courtney Kenny says, I enjoyed the show with Mark McGuinness. I'm a productivity nerd and enjoyed hearing the details. It was also serendipitous to hear you mention another listener had written about being recently laid off and making the best of it. That was my situation a year and a half ago. A layoff got my creative juices stirring. My first book was about my layoff experience and just started running some Amazon ads for that. So awesome to hear people who've, gone through that change and doing really well. So fantastic. Melissa Hartfiel says, listening to the show with Mark McGuinness. Oh no, I listened to the show with Mark McGuinness three times. So much good stuff in it to absorb. Thank you so much, Melissa. Marie Madigan says, listening to the show with Mark McGuinness while doing my tax return, the first one with book sales income. Really brilliant, Marie. That is how we all start. At some point, there is some income and you report it and pay tax on it. And it's like, woohoo. So I hope that you'll have to pay loads more tax in the future as you make loads more money. Okay, Taryn Blackthorne says, a farmer's friend waves hi as I pass by listening to the show. If you stop creating, we would miss you. And it was a picture of a snowman. Then I had two pictures that literally came in at the same time. Tim Hewitt, listening to your podcast while traveling from Toronto to North Carolina, and sent a picture out of a plane window of blue sky and clouds. And Timothy Bond sent a picture of the Alps, said, listening to your podcast while flying over the Alps on the way to Milan. So that was really cool because two listeners flying in two different continents. very pleased about that. And then finally, I also wanted to just give a shout out to Dean Dibbling, who sent me a lovely letter and an illustration, which is really, really cool. I've got it here with graveyards and death and things. It's really awesome. So thank you for that, Dean, and the lovely letter. So thanks for all the emails and tweets and presents. People have sent me presents, which is lovely. And I really appreciate all of that and love to hear from you. So you can tweet me at The Creative Pen, send me pictures of your binge listening over Christmas. You know you want to. And also email joanna@thecreativepen.com. And I really love the interaction we have. It's super duper. So today's episode is sponsored by everyone supporting on Patreon. And I really, really appreciate your support on Patreon. It makes a huge difference. And of course, we were able to move to just one corporate sponsor because so many people are now supporting the show. And it means so much that you want the show to continue enough to chuck in a dollar or two a month. Some of you even more than that. So thank you so much. Thanks to all patrons, and especially those long-term patrons, because you guys have been giving for over a year now, and I really appreciate that. Thanks also to new patrons this week: Adam Hennig, Nick Cooper, Ron Vitali, Kate, We3, and Games Finder. I really do appreciate your support. So if you'd like to support the show, you can give just $2 a month or whatever you like, but less than a coffee a month, and you'll get that extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording next week for December. Okay, so you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you, everybody, and let's get on with the interview. Today I'm here with Melissa Addy. Hi, Melissa.
Hello, Joanna.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Melissa writes historical fiction, non-fiction, and magazine articles. She has a master's degree in innovation and has worked in product and packaging development as well as business mentoring. In 2016, she has been working as Leverhulme Trust's writer-in-residence at the British Library, based in the Business and Intellectual Property Centre. And her latest book is Merchandise for Authors: Engage Your Readers While Increasing Your Income, which all of which I had to put everything in the introduction because it's so interesting. So Melissa, why don't you start by telling us a bit more about your background and how story and business have intersected in your own history and how you got into writing?
Okay, so I spent about 15 years in the business world, mostly for retailers, so Sainsbury's and M&S and people like that. First doing a lot of product innovation and packaging design and development. And then after that, I was mentoring entrepreneurs for a number of years. And that was a really fun job because I just met all these entrepreneurs and they tell me their story and I try and find ways of helping them. And we had a grant giving program that we were doing at the time. And I think that sort of rubbed off eventually, because when I started doing more and more of my own writing, I suddenly thought, well, yeah, let's go indie. Let's do it my way, because I think it just rubbed off on me the way that they thought about things and the way that they treated their work as a business. And I thought that was a really interesting way of doing things. And at the point, just at the point where I managed to go full time, two small children, so it's not very full time. But at the point where I managed to do that with the writing, I got the chance to be at the British Library, which was amazing. It's been the most brilliant year. But with them, it was great because they have the Business and IP Centre. We did this bid, which talked about the twin themes of storytelling for business and business for storytellers. So it was looking at writers being much more entrepreneurial and business-like about their work, and looking at businesses trying to be more creative and trying to find a way to tell their stories better. So that was brilliant for me, because at the point where I was moving from the business to the writing, I had a chance to bring the two things together and work with other people on it and run workshops and think through my ideas. And so on the storytelling side for the businesses, we came up with the Storytelling Entrepreneur, which is about how they can tell their stories better. But on the authorial side, we came up with the book about merchandise, because I felt how come all these writers aren't creating their own products, aren't doing their own merchandise, when for indie filmmakers and for indie bands, that's a big thing. That's something they do. So how come the writers aren't doing it? And if you go and look at literary merchandise somewhere, for example, like Etsy, you'll see a ton of the stuff. It's mostly for old dead writers because they're out of copyright, so everyone can make money from their work. So that's fair enough. But it shows that there's a demand out there. It shows that people who love books also like having the products that go with those books. And so I thought, okay, let's find a way of making that merchandise development interesting and easier for writers who might be new to it.
So you started to talk there a bit about why authors should consider merchandise. You mentioned that there is a demand, and that's totally true. Like you see, I bought my husband some cufflinks made from the text of Lord of the Rings, which, you know, which actually probably is not allowed. Well, you know, Lord of the Rings is still, I think, in copyright, but you know, they were using the kind of cast off pages from books. Yes. So that's probably on the line of being acceptable. But sort of give us some other reasons why authors should consider merchandise in the first place. Like, what are the benefits?
Yeah. So I sort of, in my mind, I have a list of five things that it should be doing for you. The number one thing is it should bring in some income, because all writers appreciate income. And so that's a good way of starting off to think it could bring in some income. That means you need to check it's going to be profitable. So there is no point at all in you creating all kinds of fantastic products and merchandise that aren't profitable, because in that case they're just gifts, which is lovely, but you can't just be handing out gifts to everybody interminably. That's not very good business. So that's one item. They need to add to your credibility. So they need to either draw your readers further into your world. So that's about enhancing the reader experience. Or, for example, if you teach creative writing, you might have something like a creative writing prompt or a book about it or something like that. So it's enhancing your credibility. It can increase your readership, because if someone comes across the product before they come across your books, they're going to think, wow, this is a fantastic product. So where is this coming from? Where are the books? And so then they're going to go and find your books. So that's a way of increasing your readership. And it can increase your visibility, because it doesn't really matter if the person buying your product doesn't like necessarily your genre, for example, because they become aware of you, and that means they can spread the word about you, because you don't know who they know who will say, oh, but I really love such and such a genre, and they'll go, oh, I know this writer because I've got some of their items. So that's a way of thinking about, is a piece of merchandise worth investing the time in? If it can do some, and preferably all of those things, then you're onto a winner.
Yeah, and that's great. And I know people listening are going, ah, but I'm not a designer and how do I make stuff? We're going to come to those things, people listening. So don't worry about that. We're just proceeding slowly. So the next question would be, you mentioned there, check that it will be profitable. So, you know, in the romance author space right now, a lot of romance authors do a lot of what you were mentioning there would be more like gifts. Like, they're doing merchandise that are based on their books, but it's more of a fan giveaway type thing. So is that the difference between merchandise and a product, or what? How are you defining merchandise and products?
Okay, so merchandise and products. I'm going to take the Harry Potter books because it just makes it very easy to explain. If you create a wand product, that's a piece of merchandise because it belongs to the Harry Potter world and it draws you, the reader, deeper into that world. If, on the other hand, J.K. Rowling was to bring out a range of notepads, that's relevant to her as a writer, but it's not actually anything to do with the Harry Potter world. So it's just a product. And that's fine, because some people have products rather than merchandise, but that's the difference between the two. People talk interchangeably about them as well, and I do it as well, but it's just worth bearing in mind, what is it you want the item to do? Is it just a nice product that you're going to sell that has some relevance to you generally as a writer, or is it a piece of merchandise, in which case it needs to enhance the reader's feeling and connection to the world that you've created?
Oh, that's really interesting. So what would those cufflinks be then with the text of Tolkien?
Oh, I would say that was leading you into the world, because it's reminding you, when you're looking at that, it's reminding you something of that. It's reminding you that is what the you know, the text that you've enjoyed that brings you back to it. So Haruki Murakami has a diary app, And that's got a little, it's basically just a simple calendar app, but what it has in there is little references to his books, little quotes from them. He's even got some exclusive stories. So again, that's pulling you back to him, to his text, to his world that he's created.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Okay, so you've given us a few examples there, the wand, the notebook, the app. And again, people are starting to think, oh my goodness, you know, that might be too expensive. And on the other end of the scale, one thing that I think is kind of pointless is so many authors seem to spend money on bookmarks, which, you know, I think are sort of probably the cheapest thing you can do, but possibly the most useless. So what are some other like examples of merchandise that wouldn't break the bank and maybe some other like really cool examples?
Okay, so the best one I've come across so far, which I just thought was wonderful, is actually in the book, and it's a woman called Catherine J. Martin. She's an author and a speaker in America, and she does a lot of talking. And when she does, she has this poem that she wrote, and it's about kind of time passing by and families coming and going and all sorts of things, a whole sort of reflection on life generally. And all she does is she has this copied onto really nice quality paper, and she has it available when she speaks, and she says it's available for a donation, you know, $1, $3, that kind of thing. And almost everybody always gets it. And sometimes they get multiple copies of it, and they frame it and they give it to friends. And it's just because it's a very heartfelt piece and it goes with what she's talking about. Now you think that is pence to make that item, and yet people are happy to buy it for a couple of dollars. And she is, you know, that has gone for years and years and years and years, this poem, and it's doing wonderfully well for her. And it just ties in very well to who she is and what she's talking about. So I think that is my favorite example of something that just costs practically nothing and is doing very well decade after decade. So that's that one. In terms of crazy expensive but pretty amazing stuff, I did just see that you can buy the throne from Game of Thrones.
Oh, cool.
It weighs 159 kilos. That's like 300 plus pounds. It costs £20,000, and it takes 8 weeks delivery because they've got to make it for you. But you know, if that's your big thing, then go for it. But I did find that one quite amusing. Really.
Wow. Do you know what? If it can't be the throne for 20 grand, because I'm already thinking that would be really cool. I think they must be replicas. You know, like they do replica of the one, like my husband. It has to be a replica. My husband does have a one ring in New Zealand, but like all these shops selling the one ring. It's like, it's not the one ring. There are lots of them. But
I think with the Game of Thrones, you don't even have to fight or anything for it. You just
get it. but that's really interesting, because, you know, I'm not going to spend 20 grand on that throne, but I bet you they sell thousands of them. Like I bet
there are some people out there.
Yeah, I think there would be people really up for that. And but what's interesting, the poem is really interesting, because so many times I've said on this show, you know, poets write for love, not money. What you've just given there is an example of a poet, or you know, she does other things. She's not directly only doing poetry, but using a poem in some kind of merchandise is brilliant. And actually, it's how people feel, right? So what she's doing is you felt something about this poem, so now you want to take it away with you. And I think creating merchandise around emotional aspects of your work is probably the way forward.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I think if you want to find merchandise within your own books, thinking about the feeling that you want to evoke is a very good way to start, especially for nonfiction. For nonfiction, it works really well to think, what is the feeling that people are buying this book for? You know, are they trying to help themselves be a better something or another, you know, parent, lover, whatever? Are they trying to, you know, feel better about themselves? Are they trying to feel better about the world? You know, whatever it is, the feelings are very important, especially for a nonfiction. And then I think for fiction, that can be important as well, that feeling perhaps of being swept away into a new world or something. And also thinking about those senses and going through your work and thinking to yourself, what are, for each of my senses, what could draw me into the world that I've created? So, you know, is it something you could eat? Is it something you would look at? Is it some sort of texture, the sounds, the smells, those sorts of things?
Yeah, that's super cool. And I mean, I think we kind of use up a lot of our imagination on the book itself. And, you know, you asked at the beginning, sort of, why aren't more authors doing this stuff? And I think it's almost that we assume that the words are the product, like are the end of the product. And also, I think we don't necessarily know what people might buy. So you know, you interviewed a lot of people for the book. And I imagine that some of the mistakes were not checking that people might actually buy this stuff. So what are some of the mistakes that people have made with merchandise?
Yeah, so a couple of mistakes. Just generally not being profitable. That is a mistake, just straight from the start. One lovely author, she did a really nice little kind of, like a postcard with a little image thing and a map and all sorts of really cute, but she didn't package it as for sale. And so people kind of came to events that she did and then just went, oh, that's nice. I'll just take that home then. And she's going, actually, no. And so that was just a tiny mistake. But what she did then was find nice little, like plastic bags that you could put it into, like a little slip cover, and put the price on it. And then immediately that becomes a product for sale rather than people just thinking it's something they can just take. So that was an error not to make. And another one that I liked was... an author who did a beautiful coloring book, an adult coloring book based on his take on Alice in Wonderland, which was kind of a game book with choices and things. And the coloring book is beautiful, but the drawings were taken directly from the book and they were too shaded in. So there wasn't enough space for you to do your coloring, really. It was too dark. However, that book sold so incredibly well for him. So he's definitely doing more of them, but he's going to have two sets of drawings done, one that's not shaded in and one that is.
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned their sets of drawings done. And this is the point, because I know people are sitting there going, but I'm a writer. I don't do design work. So how can people find a designer? Like, what is the best way to do that before we get to the kind of the websites you can get stuff made?
Sure. So some writers do also illustrate, and I think they've just got their merchandise kind of on a silver platter for them. So they're good. But for the rest of us that can't even draw sick people, you can do things like, for example, go on Fiverr and find people who are designers, illustrators. So there's a guy who does writing maps. He's called Sean Levin, and he does beautiful maps that open up, and they've got all different writing prompts for creative writers. And he uses different designers each time, and he often gets them from Fiverr, and he'll look and see what kind of work have they done already. Does it fit with his image of what those maps should contain? So that can be a really good way forward. Obviously, ask other people. If you see someone who's had a really nice piece of illustration done for them, then that's a good way to get somebody that's recommended. But that can be a way of finding illustrations, or find an illustrator as well, whose work you've seen in books, and contact them and see if they'd like to do work together.
Yeah, and I'll mention a previous sponsor of the show, 99designs.com/Joanna. 99designs do a lot of this merchandise stuff design, or graphic designers in general. So there are lots of graphic designers who are now doing book cover design, who are originally, kind of graphic designers. And this is definitely an area that I would see many of those designers getting into over time.
Yes.
So let's also just talk about... briefly about IP rights to the copyright of images. So how can people be sure that they are using images? Like, obviously, if you commission something, then you're getting something original. But what should people watch out for when using images on merchandise?
Okay, so first of all, you need to make sure that, for example, if you've used an image from an image bank, you need to check under what conditions did you get agreement to use that. And quite often some images can be licensed, for example, for your website just to illustrate something nice, but they don't actually want you to use it in a commercial way in terms of selling that image on. So that's something that you always need to check. They do obviously have licenses as well for using it commercially. So it's just checking, if you buy it from an image bank, which license you've bought it under. And certainly if you're commissioning someone, making sure that those rights are coming to you and that you're able to carry on using them. So that's worth checking.
Yeah, exactly. And we, as writers who make money from our copyright, from our intellectual property rights, it's so important that we get this image stuff correct. So I really urge people to look at your license. So for example, I use Big Stock Photo to get images for the website, but I know, like you mentioned, they have a license on them. Also, sometimes the images we get for our book covers might only be licensed for, say, 100,000 copies, and that might sound a lot, but you never know. If something takes off, like I was talking with my designer, we use one of the images we use on a number of books is a couple running, and we use that on a number of books. So obviously, if you use the same image on a number of books, you know, you're gonna sell more. And then at some point, we were like, oh, we might actually need to buy another license for that image.
Yes, you might run out a lot quicker than you were expecting to.
Exactly. So I really want people to note this as a very important fact for your website, and also, like, another sort of a little story. A friend of mine recently had a guest post from somebody on her website, and the person, you know, submitted an image with their guest post, and then you know, that she assumed had been checked for the royalty free, and then she got a invoice from Getty Images for like $1,000, because, you know, this person had just taken an image off the internet, and Getty, as you know, people listening, is the most expensive image licensor out there. So
you do need to be careful about this kind of thing. You need to know where an image comes from and who's got the rights to it.
Yeah. Okay. So just something really simple, like a mug. So I just recently did one on society6.com, which I haven't actually really talked about very much or tried to sell. It has sold a couple of copies. But what are your, and Julie Huss, who's been on the show, recommended society6.com. Yeah. But what are the best places for doing this kind of print on demand merchandise, which will cost a lot less than getting stuff made?
Yes, I think just as we've had the print on demand with books, so people who are used to that will understand the concept that now you can have that on products. I mean, in the book, I just talk about Zazzle and Cafe Press as two of the possible places, just because they have a lot of products available that you can have branded. I mean, they've got guitar picks all the way through to kitchen clocks. So they have a really, really wide range of things. And it's very straightforward and very simple to understand how it works. And you have your own kind of little shop within their shop, which obviously you can link to from your website. So that's a nice, straightforward, simple one. There are then also tons and tons of websites who do more niche products, or they've got particular areas that they're interested in. So there's a lovely one called Spoonflower, and they do fabrics. So you can design your own fabric. You can design little kits for people to go and make, like, a pair of pajamas or a bag, and they will send out all the stuff that goes with it, so the fabric and the instructions and all the rest of it. So there are places that specialize in particular things. There's even a place, I like their name, that's why I like talking about them, called Harvey Maria, and they do vinyl flooring, and you can have any image you want put onto a vinyl floor, and then they'll just send it to you ready for your bathroom floor, whatever. So I've got a lily pad on my floor, but you could have the cover of your book if you were very egocentric, or, you know, something relevant to your books, which might be fun.
Yeah. And I think, well, the point there is that there are more and more options for this type of print on demand. And like, I've had Kevin on to talk about 3D printing, and, you know, he was mentioning, you know, now that you don't necessarily need you don't have a 3D printer in your house, you just upload the pattern to, I can't remember the website name, but then they print it and it arrives in the post. So
I know, it's amazing.
It is. So this is the thing. I mean, and it's funny, and again, people are like, what, why is Joanna Penn talking about physical products? Because I've been so digital for years. But it is, I think it's really interesting. Now, let's just take it further. So obviously, with print on demand, as we know with print books, you get lower profit. I mean, you don't have to pay up front, but your profit is lower. So what if somebody goes, look, I know that I can sell 2,000 mugs because I'm going to do this particular event, or I'm going to give them away in my ticket price for an event or something. So I want 2,000 mugs done. So where are the places to look if people actually want to do this kind of short production run?
So if you're looking at doing something more like that, then that would be the moment to go and find a place that is actually much more specific to whatever it is that you want to have made. So I know that you were asking me earlier about journals and about how you could have a really beautiful journal made, for example. And there's actually a website called brandbook.de/n, and they are absolutely beautiful journals, and you can have it customized however you want. And the sort of basic ones start about €14, which isn't that bad, and you buy 25 of them as a minimum, but they will do, you know, you have to have multiple copies, not just one at a time, but they do start at just 25 of them, or you can customize them beyond belief. I had quite fun adding, you know, gold to everything, and all the end papers were in scarlet, and I add all sorts of fancy bits to it. And the more fancy bits you add to it, the more they then go, okay, you need to contact us for a bespoke quote. But the thing about that is that if you can find somewhere that really specializes in something, then they will be able to do you a much more interesting job of it, and also larger quantities for a better deal.
No, that is awesome. And you know, for people listening, I am really hardcore considering doing a premium notebook in 2017, like in time for the Christmas season, because you know, I use notebooks all the time, and a couple of other people I know have come out with these custom notebooks this year. And as I mentioned before, sort of workbooks are an obvious thing to do with your print on demand nonfiction. But yeah, I think like custom notebooks for writers is a really good place to start. And I mean, a lot of people are interested in t-shirts. Do you have specific sort of ideas on t-shirts?
I think with t-shirts, the more fun things that I've seen done are, there's a big trend at the moment for having like vast quantities of text on it. So it's like practically the whole book on one t-shirt, and they look amazing. And I've seen a fantastic girl on Etsy called Ruby, and she does skirts that have got, it's kind of black at the top, but then the bottom part has pieces from Hamlet or pieces from Pride and Prejudice or whatever. And I just think that would look really cool to have, you know, your actual text from the book onto pieces of fabric, rather than trying to find a special quote from it or something, just having lots of the text, because it looks very graphic, it really draws the eye.
I think the site's called Teespring, the print on demand t-shirt. Would that be right?
Specifically for t-shirts, yes. But I mean, almost all the sites that do products printed on demand will do t-shirts.
Yeah, the only thing I would say on that is, like, years ago I did do something through Zazzle for a t-shirt, and the quality just wasn't there. So one really important point, I think, if you're going to do merchandise, is create one and then buy one yourself. Like,
definitely
before you tell anyone, you've got to get one. So I've got I've got here on my desk, I've got my creative mug, which is quite cool. but at the moment, yeah, there's very few of them, which is awesome. Okay, so the other thing is what I wanted to talk to you about was contracts and intellectual property rights, since you've been at the British Library. Yep. Which, you know, we're going to be talking about much more on the show in 2017. But I have two examples of interesting people. So one is David Morrell of First Blood or Rambo fame, who came on the podcast and talked about a very important clause that made sure he has been getting a percentage of merchandise associated with Rambo since the 1970s. And they're about to bring out Young Rambo. They're about to start using his stuff all over again. And so David is smiling all the way to the bank. Meanwhile, I saw just this weekend, Carrie Fisher from Star Wars signed away the rights to her image when she was 19 doing the first Star Wars movie. And she has not had any money from her image, so presumably all those action figures and just so much that was done wrong there. So what other sort of horror stories or good stories have you heard about this sort of clauses, and what should people watch out for?
So first of all, if you're being published by a traditional publisher, you need to look at the contract and see what's happening with the merchandising, because sometimes it's excluded, so it's not in there at all. So then it's yours to keep. If it is included in there, you do need to make sure you're getting a percentage of it. If it's been included, but your publisher hasn't done anything with it for quite some time, it's worth contacting them to see if you can get it back. Because if they're not doing anything with it, and you're going to create something interesting that might push the book, that should be really in their interests as well. So it's worth, even if they've been signed away without you realizing, it's worth going back and just checking, well, what have they done with it? And could you possibly get them back? So that's something worth checking, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And if you are going to sign a contract with a publisher, I mean, I think it would depend, right? I mean, like, I've got an idea right now from a whole nother series. I think mainly because of this Fantastic Beast stuff that's been happening, yeah. That, you know, and this is a great example again, isn't it? Because it was a throwaway kind of comment in one of the books that there was a textbook that this guy had written. And now they've made this whole new franchise out of a textbook mentioned in the book.
I know, it's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. And I guess the question will be, like, what type of publisher are you signing with? If you're signing with a small boutique press, it's very unlikely they're going to have the size and scale to actually merchandise your book. Like, for example, I would love my Arcane series to be, you know, in gaming, because it's very, you know, fighting and leveling and sort of missions and stuff. But a small press is never going to do that. So, you know, should authors consider the, you know, what the publisher's doing with merchandising with other books if they're going to sign with someone?
Yes, definitely. Just have a look. What do they already do? Ask them, what do they already do? And if they're wanting your merchandise, right, you need to ask them, well, what are you going to be doing with it? And is that something that you feel has got legs, that you're happy with, and that you want a cut off, because otherwise you're going to be cut out of it, and you don't know how much that might take off. And also look at, you know, what kind of contacts do they have, and what sort of skills do they have for taking it forward. It's no good them buying the merchandise rights and then they don't actually ever do anything with them. That's kind of pointless, because you can't benefit, and they're not going to do anything with it. So that would be a mistake, I think.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, in the same way we've seen in the indie community, we've seen the rise of freelancers, you know, freelance cover design, freelance editing is the kind of basic level. But now there's lots of service companies helping people publish. I think freelance merchandising, I don't know what you would call it, like a consultant or a, like this guy, Sean Levin, you mentioned, I went on his website after I read your book, and, you know, he does take pitches, and basically he acts more like a project manager, doesn't he, for sort of organizing merchandise. And I think that's a real gap in the market. Like, I would love to sit down with someone and say, here's my ideas. And they're like, oh, well, we could do this and, you know, this and that and the other. And they'd know all the right sites. So is there such a thing as a merchandise project manager?
Not that I've seen yet, but I think it would be an interesting thing to get into. I mean, I think what you want is someone that's got a lot of contacts with the illustrators, with the providers, who actually, you know, the manufacturers, and who can bring that together in a way that works for each writer. What I don't really like is very sort of bland, let's all do a bookmark, let's all do, you know, something that isn't very interesting. And then it's just, you know, your name on it or something, and it doesn't really pull you into the world or really add to the interest around that author. And that's why I think it's interesting to go more bespoke with items. So one of the things that I talk about is, if you can have experience vouchers, for example, that would be an amazing thing, because let's say that your main character shoots guns a lot. You can have someone go to a firing range and actually try what it's like to shoot a gun. Or, you know, if somebody goes hot air ballooning, take them on a hot air balloon ride, and the link that will bring to your world and their connection to your character is so strong. And I think that could be a really interesting way to go. And all you need to do in that case is, you don't have to set up your own shooting range. You need to find a company that does experience days and build in some kind of affiliate commission with them. So you say, okay, I'm going to direct people towards your site because I want them to buy these really interesting vouchers that you do for experiences because they're relevant to my books. What can we do in terms of a deal? Can you give my readers a discount? Can you give me an affiliate commission? And I think that could be a really interesting way to go, and much more bespoke to a writer.
Yeah. Oh, I like that idea. This is the thing, when you actually start kind of brainstorming options, there's so much, isn't there? You know, so
there is. There's lots of ideas, I think. If you sit there and think about what recreates your world and just go wild with your imagination, then actually there's some really cool stuff out there.
Yeah, there is, absolutely. And just one another thing on the kind of merchandising rights, and I'm including gaming in this, which may actually be a derivative right.
Yeah.
And I'm still getting into this IP right world. but I recently got an email asking to have one of my characters in a game. Now, this was a board game, so that might count more as merchandise as opposed to, you know, like a digital game. So they said, can we have one character? And, you know, even just a few months ago, I would have jumped at it. I would have gone, oh, that sounds awesome, let's do it. But then, because of what I've been learning, I learned that this entanglement, like if I licensed one character to this company, it might entangle the rights to the rest of the whole world because he was a recurring secondary character. So I basically said no. So do you think I did the right thing?
I think what you did was right in terms of you went and found out what is appropriate to that industry. And if there's an issue for them around in that particular gaming industry around they want everything or nothing, then that's a good reason to stay clear of it. If perhaps you could have said, okay, I'm classifying that as merchandise, not as gaming rights, and I want a very, maybe a way of creating a contract that was very restrictive, if you like, where they go, okay, you only have the rights to do this with them, not to do anything else with them. It would be a way of testing it to say then to go to the gaming industry and go, you know what, we've tried it on a board game and people love this character. They love the world. They love the idea of it. How about we do the whole world as a game in terms of, you know, as a gaming game rather than a board game. So that might be a way of testing it. But you do have to be very careful, as you said, that it doesn't do something that upsets that particular industry where they would then go, no, that's not acceptable within our industry. So it's always worth checking how it works in a specific industry.
Yeah, I think that is awesome. And it's so funny because the more I learn about this IP stuff, the intellectual property stuff, the more I think I need to wait. The longer I wait to sign anything, the more knowledge I can gain about these things. And one of the other, there's a difference between the do-it-yourself merchandising, like we've been talking about, or trying to license your world to other companies who might be able to package this stuff. So like for, you know, JK Rowling, there's no, you know, she has a company, Pottermore, but there's no way this film and all the merchandise associated with the film are done by Pottermore. So she would license that to companies that could do that. And I think for indies, this is where we can start thinking about making things a lot bigger, you know. And I was thinking about this, like you come from packaging originally. We have to package our world in the way that makes these companies' lives easier. So if you can present it in a way that they go, oh wow, that's amazing, then they're more likely to buy the rights. So is that the type of thing you've seen? And do you have any recommendations for kind of packaging your world?
I think in terms of what you're doing, for example, I think having an ongoing series is a really useful thing because that shows that there isn't, it's not just they've only got scope for this one book and that's it. And then there isn't really much more of a story to tell. If you've got an ongoing series, then that gives other people the opportunity to think, well, okay, so that can build into different things. It can go on a longer story. I mean, you know, all of the J.K. Rowling items, they've all done long, long books. So there's 7 in the Harry Potter, which got turned into 8 films. And there's a coming 5 just from, as you said, just from a textbook, they're going to have 5 films. So being able to see that there's that long running element to your world that you've created, I think is probably a really nice part of the package. I think being able to show that you've done some merchandising initially yourself and that there's scope for it is a nice way to show the possibilities behind it. And even things that you've turned down, you know, the fact that someone's come to you and said, can we do this with your character, shows that there's beginning to be a demand for it and an interest in it. So even the opportunities that you turn down in a way help to package your world because they help when you go to make that big pitch or that someone comes to you to talk about it. That is part of your packaging, is the things that you've turned down as well as the things that you've proven work. And also being able to have characters who not too restricted in how many characters there are, but that they've got a group around them of secondary characters who give more scope for more merchandise, for more ideas. You know, the Star Wars franchise helps partly because there's an awful lot of different figurines you can make. There's not just kind of two main people. There's loads of things that you can make into merchandise.
Mm. Oh, this is brilliant. I want to do more on this in 2017. This is an area I'm so interested in. And also, just coming back to Carrie Fisher and Star Wars, you know, she signed that contract assuming that that would be nothing, that that film would be a throwaway film that would that wouldn't go anywhere. So she signed a contract just like, yeah, whatever. And what authors, I want authors to remember this example, because your rights are or can be incredibly valuable. You know, I mean, David Morrell is, you know, with First Blood as well. When he invented John Rambo, I don't know, I haven't read the book, but you know, that character has become quite iconic. And, you know, when I interviewed David, he was like, yeah, you just don't know what is going, you know, what 40 years later, what's still going to resonate.
Yeah, that's amazing. The longevity of that builds over time even. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because even Star Wars, they did diversity films and you might have thought, well, that was it, but now there's just more and more and more Star Wars works being made, and there is a problem, of course, with somebody. I mean, partly at the time, I don't think people realised the sort of scope of what might happen to a film. So it's only examples like that have made everybody else sit up and go, "Oh, think a bit more carefully before you sign the contracts."
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So where can people find you and your books online?
So I'm on melissaaddy.com and my books are mostly on Amazon. I do have an audio book because it was a book about 100 things to do while breastfeeding. So that was a better for audio because it worked for breastfeeding mothers. But generally I'm online, and come and have a look at the website. Come have a chat.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Melissa. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.